I'm Norm Shealy. NormSheely.com. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Lynn Chad, and we're going to talk about thyroid. And I have to admit, I'm not normally intimidated by many of the issues, especially none that I have on my show, but I am about this one. It's much more complicated than I ever imagined. So glad to have her on my show. How are you, Lynn?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you tonight?
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, tell us a little bit about you.
Okay.
What you do and where we can find you.
Okay. Well, I am an integrative medicine nurse practitioner, and I have been in practice for 20 years. This is my 20th year in practice. And I have a private practice in Leavenworth, Washington, which is just a couple of hours east of Seattle in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains. My practice mostly focuses on preventative health care and helping people find an optimal level of health. So I choose lifestyle and nutrition first as my line of treatment and then move through and use things like surgery and medications absolutely as a last choice.
Now, I met you with Jay Mead at his conference. Do you have a connection with him? Because I think what he does
Yes.
is very important to you.
Yes, I do. I'm actually was invited to be a founding board member of the John Lee Institute, of which Jay Mead is also a founding board member. And John Lee was a physician in San Rafael, California, who is kind of the father of natural hormone replacement for women. And so John died about 3 or 4 years ago from a heart attack, and the Institute was started to help educate physicians and nurse practitioners and other healthcare providers about how we can naturally help women and men both achieve hormone balancing.
I think what he does is great.
Oh, it's awesome.
It really is. I think his book is great, and that's why I wanted
mm-hmm.
to bring this up.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know his website?
It's drjohnlee.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that book, the one that Jay wrote, Slim, Sane, and Sexy, and the one, What Your Doctor May Not Tell You About Menopause, I think they're just fabulous. So I just
wanted to bring that up. Right. Slim, Sane, and Sexy is a small book that Jay Mead and Aaron Lohman have written recently. And then the John Lee books are all the What Your Doctor May Not Have Told You About. And there's actually three of them. One is premenopause, one is menopause, and the third one was on breast cancer, which was an excellent, excellent book, and I highly recommend it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just get started because we got a lot to cover here.
Okay.
This is a much more complicated topic than I ever knew that it would be.
Mm-hmm.
So what does the thyroid do? And what does it mean to be hypo or hyperthyroid?
Okay. So the thyroid gland is a small gland that's located just below the Adam's apple in the neck. And it regulates how your body utilizes its energy. And so it's kind of like the gas pedal. You could think of it like that, is how the thyroid functions. And what the thyroid is regulating is basically our metabolism. So how fast we burn fat, how fast we burn glucose, it's involved in a number of endocrine activities or these messenger activities where our body talks to itself and keeps itself in equilibrium. When you are hypothyroid, your thyroid gland is functioning at a low level or suboptimally or perhaps not functioning at all. And in that situation, your metabolism slows way, way down. So it would be like taking your foot off the gas pedal. And so things in the metabolism slow down, and there's a tendency towards weight gain and feeling really fatigued, not sleeping well at night. Heart palpitations can be from that, and any number of symptoms can actually be from hypothyroidism. Oftentimes patients will say to me, you know, do you think that symptom could be related to my hypothyroidism? And I always say, yeah, because it regulates so many aspects of the body's functions that if it's a change going along with the thyroid decreasing in function, it's most likely related. When someone has hyperthyroidism, they have what's called an overactive thyroid gland. And in that case, the thyroid gland overproduces thyroid hormone, and that's like putting your foot on the gas pedal very heavily. So everything speeds up, and a lot of times heart rate will increase, people will have weight loss, hair loss, and symptoms similar to that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say the way our thyroid functions is by producing thyroid hormones. And the main thyroid hormone that it produces is T4. And so in low thyroid or hypothyroidism, T4 production drops way down. And in hyperthyroidism, T4 production increases significantly.
Do people that have bulging eyes have thyroid issue? Is that an indication?
Yes. Bulging eyes is often an indication of hyperthyroidism. There is a condition called Graves' disease, and that is an autoimmune condition of the thyroid where the individual's immune system develops antibodies that actually attack the thyroid gland and the enzymes and the hormones. And so often with that, the thyroid gland becomes overactive. And the eyes will, and it doesn't happen with everyone, it just depends on the circumstances, but the eyes will protrude out of the orbit somewhat. And it can be corrected surgically, but the idea is to try to, you know, do something before you ever get to that point.
Does it make them get other things like sore throats easier or colds or whatever?
Yes, absolutely. When someone has an autoimmune thyroid problem, and there's another one as well called Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And Hashimoto's is another condition like Graves' disease where the immune system develops antibodies against the thyroid gland. However, with Hashimoto's disease, you tend more towards low thyroid symptoms. And in either one of these cases where there's autoimmunity or antibodies against your own tissue, sometimes that will make the thyroid gland itself in the neck enlarge. And when that enlarges, it'll give people somewhat of a feeling like there's something in the throat. They can feel it when they swallow. It'll be irritated or scratchy feeling and things like that. And because there's a big connection between our thyroid function and our immune system, oftentimes when an individual has something like hyper or hypothyroidism, you know, there will be some other alterations within the immune system, so they're more likely to become ill with viruses and that sort of thing.
Interesting. My boyfriend does that, and he has a little bit of bulging in his eyes, and I've always wondered about that.
Mm-hmm.
He always has a sore throat, always. Anytime
anything
happens.
He should get that
checked out. Well, he did, and his doctor, of course, said it was fine. I'm sure they did the wrong test.
Well, oftentimes, and that's one of the things that happens in medicine nowadays, you know, we've done things a certain way for a very long time, and we tend not to sort of look at new information that's coming out. And so for years, we've done one test only when we look for thyroid problems, and that's called a TSH. And those letters stand for thyroid stimulating hormone. And that hormone is actually released by the pituitary gland in the brain, and it travels to the thyroid gland and stimulates it, tells it, in other words, to make more thyroid hormone. And so the TSH is our kind of our mainstream test for looking at abnormal thyroid function, but it's not unusual to have a normal TSH, and there's a lot of controversy about what's normal and what isn't, and have other problems with your thyroid hormones. When I test someone for thyroid function, I do a TSH, which is the thyroid stimulating hormone. That's the regulatory hormone. And then I do T4, which is called thyroxin, and that's the hormone actually that the thyroid produces. And then I do a hormone called T3, which is also called leothyronine. And that is actually the workhorse of the thyroid gland. So our thyroid gland makes T4 or produces T4, and then in our peripheral tissue, like mainly in our muscles, but also in our liver, in our brain, in women in their ovaries and breast, and in men in their testicles, that T4 is converted to T3. And your body does that by using enzymes. So it removes an iodine molecule, actually, is what it's doing. So T4 has 4 iodine molecules on it, and T3 has 3. And your body uses enzymes in order for that process to occur. Well, T3 is about 75% more biologically active than T4 is. So that's a third hormone that I always test, and then I test for the antibodies, and those are called thyroid peroxidase antibodies. So really, to get a good test of thyroid function, you need to do those 4 tests. But often we're still stuck with just doing this TSH.
I don't understand why they don't know about it.
Well, there's a lot of controversy about it, and you know what, it amazes me too, Eva, because, you know, we've known about thyroid and thyroid function. You can bring it up on Wikipedia on your, you know, on the internet, and you can read about T4 and T3 and how T3 is more biologically active. However, we just, for some reason, do not think it's important to look for that. And there's a fair amount of people out there that don't convert their T4 to T3 very readily. So you could have a normal TSH and a T4, but if you're not converting in your muscles, you're gonna feel like you've got really low thyroid function. And so that's why it's really important to test, you know, all of these tests so you can see the full functioning of the thyroid gland and not just look at the one hormone that's doing the regulation.
Well, if it's converting in your muscles and it's not doing it right, is that why some people have a lot of muscle?
Yes, absolutely. It's not unusual for people with hypo or hyperthyroidism to have a lot of muscle pain, or they don't feel like their muscles recover well after exercise. And that's generally because they're not converting their T4 into their T3. And our body uses enzymes to do that, and there are things that affect those enzymes. So iodine, for instance, is very important to thyroid function. And if you'll remember, back in the 50s, there was the story about the goiter belt. And that was an area in the Midwest where a lot of people, individuals that lived there, were developing enlarged thyroid glands. And they determined that the reason that was happening is because they were over-farming the soil, and the soil was significantly depleted of iodine. That is when we started to iodize salt, you know, when Morton salt started to become iodized. The thyroid enlarges in order to sort of like collect more iodine because it uses iodine to make thyroid hormone. As I mentioned earlier, T4 has 4 iodine molecules on it and T3 has 3. We've seen this huge increase in thyroid problems in this country, namely because of iodine deficiency. And, you know, we iodized the salt, but then we all got worried about high blood pressure and everybody quit, you know, adding salt to their food, and so we really are not getting enough iodine.
Does it help to put iodine on your skin?
You don't really absorb much through your skin. In naturopathic medicine, we've used iodine in order to test to see if you need, or we've used iodine on the skin to test to see if you need it. So if you take an iodine solution and you drop it on your skin, and within a few hours it's absorbed completely and you don't see a brown dot on your skin anymore, you need iodine, you know, if you absorb it that quickly. And that was kind of the quick and dirty way of determining iodine deficiency.
Does it help if you drop it in your water?
It's much better to drop it in your water and drink it, and that's called Lugol's solution. And there's an over-the-counter iodine supplement called Iodorol, which contains about 12.5 milligrams of iodine.
Why does that have potassium in it, too?
That just helps with the absorption much better, that potassium iodine iodide. And so it's just a much more absorbable form to have it in that way. And it's really important to take it, and there is a wonderful website to learn more about that, and that's drbrownstein.com. And he has written, he's an MD, and he's written several books on iodine and why we need it and why it's important. People that live in Japan consume about 13 milligrams of iodine in through their diets every day. And we just don't have that here in this country. They have much lower rates of thyroid issues and breast cancer and prostate cancer and other problems, which we're now seeing are linked as well to low iodine.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
I took that Iodoral one time, and it made my blood pressure zoom up so that my nose bled and squirted out blood. Is it
the iodine
or the potassium?
Well, it's hard to say. You have to be careful. It could have been the iodine. People, if you've got, sometimes within our thyroid, we can develop these little nodules, and it's just a sign that you just don't have a completely healthy thyroid gland, and oftentimes that can be related to low iodine levels. Well, nodules are classified as either hot or cold. So hot nodules are thyroid hormone producing, and cold nodules are not. So if you have a little small thyroid producing nodule and you start taking, you know, a good dose of iodine, that little nodule could really produce a fair amount of thyroid hormone, T4, and cause you to become hyperthyroid, which could make your blood pressure go up.
Interesting.
I have had that happen with patients in the past. We just backed off on the iodine, and their levels normalized. You know, it was just that simple to do that. But there are some people that don't tolerate iodine well, and if you do have any type of little hot nodule like that, you could definitely, you know, make
more. How do you know if it's hot or cold?
You can do a radioactive uptake of the thyroid. It's like an ultrasound. They do a radioactive uptake with that. I generally don't do that every time I see a thyroid nodule in someone. As a matter of fact, I usually don't, because I don't like to subject people to the radioactive iodine unless I need to. If I know someone's got thyroid nodules, I just start out with a lower dose of iodine. You know, I either start with the drops, or I just have them cut those Iodoral tablets into quarters and just start with a quarter and gradually, you know, build up the dosing over time.
Okay. Now, does thyroid have anything to do with the autonomic nervous system?
Thyroid has a lot to do with the autonomic nervous system, and mainly because in a roundabout way, along with our adrenal glands. So our adrenal glands sit on top of our kidneys, and they're what produce the hormones that adapt us to stress in the environment. So the two main hormones that your adrenal glands produce are cortisol and adrenaline. They also make DHEA and a few other hormones. Cortisol has a direct relationship with thyroid function, so that if our body thinks it's in some sort of stress mode, it will, you know, the cortisol levels will drop way down to conserve energy. When our body does that, the conversion between T4 and T3 actually decreases. And so our body does work along with the adrenals and the autonomic nervous system to sort of, you know, conserve way down and hold on to calories for a rainy day. And that's why stress is such a huge issue, and you and I were talking about that a little earlier this afternoon. You know, nowadays people are under incredible amounts of stress, much more than we ever were in previous generations. And that interplay with the cortisol hormone and other stress hormones really does have an effect on the overall thyroid function. Oftentimes, if women are low or high thyroid, they will have anxiety and nervousness, so activation of that autonomic nervous system. But all of it is definitely interrelated.
So, and this is something that's not in your book, but it makes a question, makes me think of a question. A lot of people who have mitral valve prolapse, you know, have something called dysautonomia.
Right.
Is that connected to the thyroid?
That's an interesting question, and I've wondered that a lot myself over the years with patients that I have had with that. And it's not uncommon for women that have had a history of mitral valve prolapse to have panic disorder along with that, or frequent panic attacks. I've not really found it to be, you know, a correlation necessarily between that and thyroid problems in women. And I haven't really seen that in the literature anywhere as well. Women that I've had in my practice over the years with mitral valve prolapse, it's been kind of a 50-50. You know, some of them have thyroid problems, others do not. So there hasn't been a definite correlation that I've seen with that over the years.
That's interesting. I wish somebody would look into that. That's just an interesting thing.
I know, it is interesting. That whole correlation with mitral valve and panic, you know, what causes that to happen is really interesting.
So one of the things that I think Dennis Wilson talked about at that lecture of Dr. Mead's was taking your temperature in the morning.
Right.
What does that tell us?
Well, because your thyroid regulates...
And tell us
your,
how to take it.
Yeah. Regulates your body's actual metabolism. One of the ways that you can test your thyroid function is by testing a basal body temperature. And this was the way we did it, you know, 50 years ago before we had blood tests to test actually for thyroid function. This is exactly what we did to diagnose thyroid problems in our patients. What you want to do is you want to take your temperature, and it's best to use a basal body thermometer. And the reason for that is because they go down to a lower degree. So they go down to about 95 or 94 degrees as opposed to a regular thermometer. Digital is fine, or the old glass type. And there's a couple of different ways to do it, but in general, your basal body temperature, so the lowest you're going to be, is going to be in the morning when you first wake up. So one method of checking temperature is to have your thermometer ready at your bedside, and when you wake up first thing in the morning, before you get out of bed or really move around too much, you take your temperature. And you can just do it under your tongue. Some people do it under their armpit, but either way is really acceptable. And then you record that. And, you know, a normal body temperature should be 98.4, 98.6, at least, you know, 90 in the 98 range. And oftentimes people will find that their basal body temperatures is something like, you know, 94.6 or 95.3. In Dr. Wilson's program, he actually has people check temperatures periodically throughout the day. And I think you can do it either way, because if you do have a low-functioning thyroid, you're going to see that low-functioning all throughout the day as well.
So if it's low, does that mean we're hypo or hyper?
If you've got low body temperature, that means you're hypo, you're low-functioning. So your body is not able to keep your metabolism running at a high enough level to keep your body temperature up. So your body temperature drops, and that's how we conserve calories. And that's why stress really plays a big role in all of this, because when we're under a lot of stress and our cortisol levels will initially rise, but then when they drop, your body's kind of in, I call it hunkered down survival mode, you know. And as far as your adrenals and your thyroid is concerned, there's not a meal that's going to come in for a while. That's part of the whole stress response. So the whole, you know, the whole thing slows way down. It's almost like an animal that goes into hibernation in the winter. It's the same idea. You slow that metabolism, those body functions down so low that you're conserving every calorie that you possibly can. And that's why so many women nowadays, you know, they'll try to lose weight and can't. You know, it's just really hard. You hear it all the time. They've gone to the gym, they've worked on their diet, and they've really, truly given it an effort, you know. But the pounds just aren't coming off. And that's that interplay between stress and thyroid function.
Do young people have this problem too? I mean, like teenagers?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not unusual for young folks to have thyroid problems, especially these autoimmune thyroid problems. I probably diagnose one case of Hashimoto's thyroiditis at least a week, I think, in my practice. And I've been surprised how many young women, especially 18, 19, and 20 years old, that I've diagnosed with it. We have a pretty unclean environment out there. I mean, just this last week, you know, these studies came out confirming that pesticides on fruits and vegetables are contributing to attention deficit disorder in our kids. Well, your thyroid gland is right there in your neck, and all those pesticides are going right by it, too, you know. And it affects that glandular function so that gland doesn't affect on an optimal level. So thyroid problems are really prevalent at any age, and even small young children can be born with congenital thyroid problems as well.
Interesting.
It is.
So let's see. What is the relationship in women with fibroids and bleeding problems
mm-hmm.
and endometriosis, and
right.
does that play a role too?
It really does. There's a lot of correlation between women with low thyroid functioning or hypothyroidism, uterine fibroids, heavy menstrual bleeding, and endometriosis. And the common denominator there seems to be low iodine levels that we find in all of those conditions. Fibrocystic breasts also fit into that as well. When women are low in iodine, breasts are more dense and fibrocystic. We're more likely to develop uterine fibroids, which are dense, fibrous, benign tumors within the uterus wall. And we're more likely to develop endometriosis, which is endometrial lining, breaking away from the endometrium inside the uterus and then implanting within the pelvis itself. Last year when I was doing some research for thermal imaging, which is something that I do in my practice for breast cancer screening, I actually came across 5 research articles that linked women with hypothyroidism and an increased risk in breast cancer. And I remember the day I came across those, and I kind of sat in my chair at my desk, and I thought to myself, let me think about the women, you know, in my practice that have had breast cancer. And every one that came to my mind, I realized had a history of thyroid problems. And the common denominator when I looked deeper into these studies was iodine deficiency. And we now know that iodine is implicated in an increased risk of breast cancer as well as prostate cancer. So iodine is definitely the common denominator, or iodine deficiency is the common denominator within those conditions.
What about the role of minerals?
Minerals
and amino acids.
Yeah, minerals and amino acids are very important in thyroid function, specifically trace minerals. So selenium is very important for thyroid function, and we should be getting about 150 to 200 micrograms of selenium a day. You don't want to take too much selenium because it can be neurotoxic, so you want to make sure you're adding up, you know, any that may be in multiple supplements that you're taking, so you're being sure you're not, you know, taking too much.
Mm-hmm.
Zinc is another important mineral for thyroid function and is involved in this process of converting T4 to T3. Amino acids are also important because amino acids are the growth and repair. They're the building blocks of all of our tissue. And so if we do not have adequate amino acids, then we're not going to be, you know, repairing the thyroid gland and keeping that functioning on an optimal level.
Are there specific amino acids that need to be supplemented, or just generally across the board?
That's a good question, and I don't have that, you know, with me right offhand. I would say just in general, amino acids are important. One of the aspects that's very important that involves minerals for thyroid function is the fact that there are other minerals that compete with iodine for the receptor. So when our body uses minerals or amino acids or any of these other enzymes, there's actually a receptor on the cell surface for that. Well, fluoride, bromide, and chloride, or chlorine, all use the same receptor that iodine does. So if you are having fluoride treatments done at your dentist, using fluorinated toothpaste, drinking fluorinated water, there's a possibility that you could be iodine deficient just from that, because when your body is saturated with that, with too much fluoride, iodine will not be able to get on the receptor. The other mineral that's really important, or has an important role there in competing with iodine, is bromide. And bromide is actually used as a dough conditioner now. It used to be iodine way back, and about 30 years ago or so, they switched it to bromide because it gave the bread dough a better consistency. But bromide also will compete with iodine for the receptor. There are some medications that contain bromide that are used in cardiovascular care treatment, like amlodipine, that actually contain bromide, and some asthma inhalers contain that as well. Interestingly, Mountain Dew soda pop is really high in bromide. And again, this can kick the iodine off the receptor, and then the third thing is chlorine. And a lot of folks that are drinking, you know, city water are drinking chlorinated water. So it's important to remove those things from your water for optimal thyroid functioning and to try to, you know, choose things that are bromide-free and fluoride-free when you can. Interestingly, my niece in California, she's about 20 years old, was just diagnosed with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and so she called me up. And she and her mother and I had a really long conversation together. And at one point during the conversation, I said to her, I said, hey, you know, have you ever been a Mountain Dew drinker? And both she and her mother just went, oh, my God, you know, I used to drink tons of that stuff. Her mom used to buy it by the case, you know, when the kids were growing up and they just drank a ton of it. And so I think that was probably her risk factor for the Hashimoto's. You know, she had so much bromide that she just, the iodine within her body could not function because it could not get on the receptor.
Interesting. I would imagine you know, a lot of people are swim also, and now that chlorine's absorbable through the skin.
Absolutely right. That's absolutely correct. And so a lot of folks now with hot tubs, you know, they'll switch from chlorine, but the other option is bromide. So it can be really tough to get away from if you're swimming or have hot tubs, things like that.
So what do you do? I mean,
well,
how do you fix these things?
Yeah.
I know there are pharmaceuticals.
Right.
But, you know, as
right.
I told you before, my show is really about helping people do things naturally. So how do you fix these things naturally?
Right. So here's how you fix them naturally. First of all, you look at not using fluorinated toothpaste or having fluoride treatments or using fluoride rinses or fluoride mouthwashes. You know, sometimes we just tend to get too much of that sort of thing in our body. If you tend towards cavities, you may need to talk with your dentist about that. But those of us that are eating healthy whole foods diet and brushing our teeth regularly really don't have to have issues with that. You want to decrease your intake of baked goods because that's where bromide is going to come from, and any bromide-containing foods or other products, and you'll see bromiated vegetable oil and things like that. You want to make sure that you have a good water filter at home to filter out any fluoride or chlorine that's in your water before you're drinking it. So those are the main things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good idea to take an iodine supplement. And, you know, according to Dr. Brownstein, we all should be. And I've been on iodine myself. I personally have Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And I actually take 25 milligrams of iodine a day to get my iodine levels where they need to be. And you don't need to be afraid of it, but you need to just start slow and build up and work with your healthcare provider if you need to, but it's a very safe thing to do, and there's a lot of information on the Dr. Brownstein site about that.
And we're talking about hypothyroidism.
Hypothyroidism.
Right now, right?
Okay. Yeah, treating low thyroid. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at my health food source just so I could educate my little self a
mm-hmm.
little bit, and they have a supplement that says thyroid tissue.
Right.
What is that?
Right. So there's a couple of different supplements you can buy at health food stores. Some of them just contain thyroid support in terms of minerals and vitamins. And those things usually contain thyrosine. Well, there's one amino acid. Actually, you asked me that question earlier, and it didn't pop into my brain at the time. But thyrosine is a really important amino acid for thyroid functioning. It is the primary amino acid that constitutes the makeup of T4. So tyrosine is surrounded by
tyrosine or
mm-hmm.
thyrosine?
Tyrosine.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Is surrounded by 4 iodine molecules. So oftentimes these thyroid support support formulas will contain that and iodine and zinc and selenium.
And chromium, right?
And chromium. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they will contain raw glandulars. And this is where they've taken, like, pig's thyroid glands and ground them, you know, dehydrated them, ground them up, and put them into a capsule. And this has been a pretty common practice in naturopathic medicine for, you know, hundreds of years, to use glandulars to replace elements that are missing within the thyroid. Some of those glandulars contain the enzymes, they contain a little bit of T4 in general, and so, but they're very low, generally speaking, you know, in the dosing. It's just enough to sort of help give your thyroid gland the nutrients that it needs so that you can bring it into optimal functioning. So there's two different types of supplements. Some that you'll see will contain those glandulars and some that do not. It depends on the person with me whether I'm going to prescribe those with glandulars or not. Definitely my vegan vegetarians don't get glandulars, you know. But in general, if I'm really trying to save someone's thyroid function from having to go on medication, I will use things like that in my practice.
Is there anything to be afraid of using them?
Well, again, if you had some type of, you know, underlying hyperthyroidism that was undiagnosed, you know, you could go in the other direction. Like you could go into a hyperthyroid state. And I've run across that a couple of times over the years. Like sometimes people will just have kind of borderline or fluctuating thyroid function. And their doc will think what it is hypo or low thyroid function. But over time it actually becomes hyper. And so in a situation like that where you weren't, you know, where the thyroid function hadn't changed enough yet that you definitely had a diagnosis of hyper, you could move that along a little bit with those supplements. Symptoms to look for if something like that is happening to you, though, are generally speaking, folks will get heart palpitations because thyroid hormone has a distinct effect on the heart muscle and heart function and the electrical conductivity of the heart. So oftentimes, if you're starting on thyroid supplementation like that and you start to get heart palpitations, you ought to back off on the dosing and talk to somebody, you know, before you proceed. Mm-hmm. Because it's a possibility that you could have something else underlying going on, and it's a little bit bigger picture than just a suboptimal or mildly low thyroid function.
If you have that low temperature, though, you can kind of feel safe to do it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And how should you start? Like what kind of dosage?
Well, it just depends on the product. And they all have different types of, you know, dosing. Some are extracts, some are raw materials. The extracts are more potent than those with raw materials. So it's best to follow the instructions on the label since there's so many different brands out there and I can't really, you know, talk about specific brands so much. So look at the instructions on the label. Start at the low end. Like if it says 1 to 3 capsules a day, start with 1 capsule a day. You know, do that for 2 to 4 weeks. See how you feel with that. If you're doing okay, don't notice much change, then go ahead and bump it up from there. So that's the advice I would give people. Don't start out, you know, just on the highest dose and think you're going to do all these great things for yourself, because if you're going to get into trouble, it's going to be under those kinds of circumstances.
Do you do it in the morning or when you go to bed?
It's best to do it in the morning, although there's been studies both directions. It's best to take thyroid supplementation. If you're going to actually take thyroid hormone, you want to take that on an empty stomach. And in general, most of these supplements are best on an empty stomach that way, too. You just get better absorption through the stomach lining of that.
Now, this book that you sent me, let's get the name of it, Thyroid Power by Richard Shane.
Uh-huh.
It also talks about sometimes if you take thyroid and you have adrenal problems, you get problems because they get out of whack that way.
That's exactly right.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Oftentimes people think that they've got low thyroid symptoms, when in fact what they've got is low adrenal function. And as I mentioned earlier, these things kind of go hand in hand. And your adrenal glands, which are the small glands on top of your kidneys, they're producing mainly cortisol, adrenaline, and DHEA. Cortisol is the hormone that regulates our energy production. So how much gas goes in the tank is regulated by your adrenals, whereas your thyroid gland regulates the gas pedal. So
hypothalamus, what does it do?
The hypothalamus is a gland in the brain, and it's a sensory gland. So the hypothalamus senses the levels of hormone. So when the thyroid hormone level drops in your body, your hypothalamus senses that and sends a hormonal signal to your pituitary gland. And then the pituitary gland sends out a hormonal signal either to the adrenal glands or the thyroid gland or your ovaries or testicles, depending on what hormone it is that's out of balance, in order to bring that into balance. So your hypothalamus is hugely involved in sensing these levels and sort of regulating how your body dispenses or disperses these hormones throughout the day. So when you get the signal to, so with adrenal function dropping, Your cortisol level is coming down with that. And that will make you feel tired, and it'll make you feel exhausted, and it'll make you hit a wall at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and, you know, you don't feel like you can go on the rest of the day. You can't lose weight. You gain more weight around the middle. So a lot of the symptoms are very similar to low thyroid. But the reason that is because, as I mentioned earlier, your adrenals, when you go into this low adrenal hyper, you know, hibernation mode, it is signaling your thyroid to slow down your metabolism at the same time. So that's how the two things work hand in hand. So that if you just treat someone with those symptoms with medication for thyroid function and you don't do anything about the adrenal function, the patient's symptoms will often worsen over time. Sometimes they might feel a little bit of a boost there initially, but it can actually cause more trouble down the road and cause further suppression of the thyroid function. So what you want to do is you want to address the low adrenal function first, and you can do that with herbs such as licorice, ashwagandha, cordyceps, rhodiola. There's some really good herbs to help to support adrenal function, and also vitamin B5 and vitamin C support adrenal function as well. Diet plays a huge role in this, and we all know now that the American diet is a very big problem for all of us. It's the cause of the childhood obesity epidemic, and we need to do something about it, you know, fast. So this diet, this American diet we have, I mean, we're just nutritionally poor. You know, we're calorie rich, but nutritionally poor. And so because we don't have that nutrition coming in, our adrenals feel that we're in this stress mode. And also, when you eat diets that are high in flour and sugar and high fructose corn syrup and foods like that, that causes your insulin levels to rise, which is the hormone that actually metabolizes glucose for us. And when insulin rises, that suppresses cortisol production, which is the hormone that regulates how much gas goes in our gas tank. So diet plays a huge role in adrenal function, and it's really important to eat small, frequent, very nutritious meals when you're trying to bring adrenals back into more optimal functioning. It's really the only way you can do it, along with the herbs and supplements.
What foods specifically are you talking about?
So I mean like whole foods, like, you know, lots of whole grains, steel-cut oats, whole grain breads that aren't made out of flour. You know, there's breads that you can buy, and they're called flourless, and it doesn't necessarily mean there's no flour in them. It just means that that flour is ground in a much coarser way, and there's a lot more of the whole grain and fiber within those breads. Fresh fruits and vegetables, seeds and nuts, legumes, beans, all of those kinds of things throughout the day. We have a tendency to eat a lot of foods that are made out of flour in this country, a lot of bread, a lot of pasta, cereals, crackers, pretzels, those kinds of foods. And they're calorie rich, but they're nutritionally low. So, for instance, for breakfast, you want to eat something like steel-cut oatmeal with raw nuts and fruit on that, or sunflower seeds and fresh fruit with that. For snacks, you want to have things like pieces of organic fruit and nuts, or fruit and seeds, or vegetables dipped in hummus, things like that. For lunches, you want to have healthy sandwiches with a lot of vegetables, or really healthy salads with sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, garbanzo beans. I mean, lots of healthy plant proteins and things like that. And we want to try to stay away from too much milk, white rice, white flour, you know, all these white foods that are nutritionally void.
Did you say milk?
Milk. And I know that's a controversial one, and nobody...
We don't drink milk in my house anymore.
Yeah, and I haven't in my house for years either. You know, we're the only species that drinks milk beyond childhood, and it really is not a good thing for us to do. Milk has changed a lot over the years. You know, when I was a kid, we got milk from the dairy up the street, and it was non-pasteurized, non-homogenized, just regular old milk, and there were no hormones in it. Now it's loaded with growth hormone, and there's quite a bit of sugar in milk. It's homogenized, it's pasteurized, so it's nutritionally void, really, other than it just being kind of a source of sugar.
Dead with a bunch of chemicals in
it. That's exactly right. And we don't realize how much hidden sugar is in our diet. I mean, a lot of my patients will eat things like, you know, yogurt with fruit in it. Well, most of the brands of yogurt that contains fruit, those contain about 25 grams of sugar. Well, a gram of sugar is about a teaspoon's worth, you know, and so of white sugar. So if you're eating yogurt with fruit in it, you just ate about 5 teaspoons of white sugar. So we consume a lot of sugar. One cup of milk, 1 8-ounce cup of milk, has the equivalent of 2 teaspoons of sugar in it. So, you know, if you're, and nobody drinks 8 ounces, they're drinking at least 12, you know, so they're getting a good 3 teaspoons worth of sugar in that. So we have a lot of hidden sugar in our diet, and that suppresses adrenal function.
What about soy milk and soy products?
Soy is a great substitute as long as you don't, as long as you're not allergic to soy. One of the problems with soy now that we have to be careful about is that a lot of it is genetically modified. So of course you want to stay away from genetically modified soy. You know, this, our bodies don't recognize that. You're more likely to have an allergic reaction to it, so you want to stay away from that. There's been a lot of controversy about soy over the years. You know, some people still, you know, there's the pro-soy people and there's the con-soy people. I went to a whole conference one time and the whole day, you know, half the day was pro, the other half was con. And I left at the end of the way, end of the day saying to myself, okay, so this is about moderation. You know, this is about eating whole soy food. So to me, if we have soy, some whole soy milk in our diet, and you want to buy the ones that are just organic soybeans and water. You know, you want to avoid carrageenan, which is an additive that they use for thickening because that has been shown to be carcinogenic now. So you want to buy a good organic brand that lacks these other additives.
I have a question here.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it says it's organic, does that mean it's non-GMO?
Not necessarily. It should say non-GMO on the label as well. You could assume that, but you better find out for sure because that may not be 100%. May not be 100%. But a little bit of tofu in your diet, some edamame, you know, where you cook the whole soybean and eat the fresh soybeans, those are very tasty. There's no reason why we shouldn't incorporate whole soy into our diet. I don't recommend soy isoflavones, and that's when they remove the soy isoflavones from the soy and put them into a capsule. One of the main reasons I don't recommend that is because it actually suppresses thyroid hormone function. And so a little bit of soy in the diet is okay, but too much or these soy isoflavones can actually suppress thyroid hormone functioning. When I see patients now with hyperthyroidism, and I actually learned this from Richard James, a talk that he gave later, the author of that book, there's a drug that we use for people with hyperthyroidism called Tapazole. And we use that drug to get their thyroid function, you know, to get their thyroid hormone levels down because when the levels go up, they get rapid heartbeats and heart rates and their blood pressure goes up and things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, you can do the same thing by giving soy isoflavones to somebody. And so I use soy isoflavones, alpha-lipoic acid, and another supplement that comes actually from cruciferous vegetables. They're called goitrogens. I actually use those three things to treat hyperthyroidism. So that's why it's not a good idea to take fractionated soy isoflavones because it can suppress thyroid function.
What about fish oil? Well, omega oil.
Mm-hmm. Fish oil and omega-3s are important for inflammation. So when I'm treating someone with an autoimmune thyroid problem, whether it's Hashimoto's or Graves' disease, that is a, you know, immune system on fire kind of a condition, inflammation within the immune system. And then, of course, the thyroid gland itself becomes inflamed because of the attack from the antibodies. I use fish oil in those folks, DHA, EPA, and I use 1 to 2,000 milligrams a day to decrease the inflammation. The other thing I use to treat those people is vitamin D. And, of course, you know, there's been a lot about vitamin D here on the news the last couple of years, and I've been checking a lot of my patients' levels, and it truly is an epidemic of low levels, mm-hmm. especially here where we are in the Northwest. We're far from the equator, and we just the angle of the sun is not right for us between October and something like February or March to even manufacture vitamin D. Well, we know that vitamin D plays a huge role in the immune system and immune function and health. So when I'm treating autoimmune thyroid problems, I always optimize vitamin D levels. Generally speaking, when you have a vitamin D level drawn, you're testing something called the 25-hydroxy vitamin D level. And most labs, that ranges between 30 to 100. People that live at the equator, their levels are approximately 150. So I like to get my patients up between about 75 and 100 when I'm treating autoimmune conditions. The only documented case of toxicity ever, the levels were over 300. So you're pretty safe taking between 2 and 5,000 IUs of vitamin D daily. And it's not a bad idea to see your healthcare provider and just ask for a vitamin D test after you've been doing that consistently for about 6 months so you can see where you're at. And then if you're not, you know, within that optimal range yet, then you'd want to increase your dose and, you know, check again in 6 months until you get into that optimal range.
I interviewed somebody about that named James Dowd, and he's got a fabulous book called The Vitamin D Cure. And just for my listeners, if you go to his website, he gives you a chart because it's fat soluble, so and it has something to do with your weight. And he tells you how much you need to take based on your weight, based on where you are in the world.
Yep.
So it was very interesting.
Yeah, I should look for that. I've heard of that book, and I've been wanting to look
at that.
It was
fabulous. I mean, he did a great job.
And it's amazing to me how much vitamin D helps. You know, I start women on vitamin D, and the arthritis in their hands improve. They got sick with colds and bronchitis all the time. That stops. Bone density turns around. I mean, when I get these women's levels of vitamin D up where they belong, you know, osteoporosis starts to turn around, and I've had some really great success with that as well.
Well, we only have like 7 or 8 minutes.
Okay.
And I'm going to say one thing, and then I'm going to let you talk about whatever you want to talk about that we've not talked about.
Okay.
In this book, I thought it was very interesting that you brought, well, that this man brought mind-body in with hypothyroidism, because I could relate, protection and rejection, self-esteem issues, and then OCD, addiction, dependence, and independence issues.
Absolutely.
What do you have any comment about that? Why is that? Do you know? Because it sure rang a bell with me personally. But
I think, first of all, you know, our throat chakra is right there where our heart chakra is right there where our thyroid gland is. And if you are holding back things that you need to say in life to yourself and to others, if you're swallowing words, your throat is going to close up. I mean, and that's, I'm speaking energetically here, you know, but that's kind of the feeling that happens. You don't speak your mind, you're going to have problems within that chakra area. So I think that's why we see so many thyroid problems in women. I mean, now at menopause, about 1 out of every 4 women have thyroid problems. I mean, Oprah just ended up with one. And it was, I mean, people were sending her emails going, hey, your thyroid's enlarged. But, of course, none of them were trickling down to her. And she went to 4 or 5 other doctors before, you know, she got diagnosed. But I think it's a common problem in women because we tend not to say what we need to say a lot of the time. And we stuff our emotions and we hold them in because we don't want to hurt somebody else's feelings or step on somebody else's toes. And so I think it's important for us in a loving way to be able to say to people in our lives how we really feel and what we really think. And, of course, there's a kind and loving way to do that, and I encourage every one of your listeners to learn about that. Because holding back words that need to be said are probably one of the worst things that we can do to our health in terms of this mind-body connection.
I totally agree.
And I'm just a big believer in that, and I see it, you know, over and over again. And it's almost like, you know, 30% of the women in my practice have thyroid problems. I mean, it's a very big problem. I think we need to look at our diets, how we relate to other people in the world, Certainly, if we're sensing a lot of stress in our lives and we're not happy in our jobs or at home and we feel like we're giving too much of ourselves up, you know, those things are going to affect our adrenal glands adversely, and that's going to trickle down to your thyroid. So stress hugely affects your thyroid function. And learning how to manage stress in your life, taking a step back, filling that bathtub up with hot water and turning the world off for a little while is an important thing for us to do on a regular basis. We've been taught for years not to really care for ourselves because somehow that's selfish, or, you know, we should be doing for others and not ourselves. I went to nursing school 25 years ago, and a wise instructor said to our entire class, we take care of others with that comes out of or overflows out of our cup. So you gals, well, there was one guy in our class, but you gals and one guy, you need to take care of yourselves because that's how you'll be able to take care of others. And I took that to heart that 25 years ago, and I still believe it today. And it makes a big difference. You need to, as mothers, especially those of us that are 50-plus nowadays and sit, you know, sandwiched between our moms and our kids and trying to make everything right for everybody in their lives, you need to value yourself, and you need to do it for yourself, too. And the other people around you will benefit from that 10 times over. It's not a selfish thing to do.
So take another couple of minutes and tell us where to find you again and how people can contact you. Or
Thanks, Eva. So where I am is I'm in Leavenworth, Washington, which is a small little town a couple hours east of Seattle. I do have a website, and that is www.lynnchad.com. And the spelling, it's LynnChad.com. And all of the information about what I offer in my practice is on the website. I enjoy what I do on a daily basis and help people to achieve optimal health. Medications and surgery are the last thing that I use in my toolbox, and hopefully I'll be able to, over the next few years with educating physicians at conferences, get them to make that decision as well.
Do you do phone consultations?
Absolutely. I do phone consultations as well as face-to-face visits. I have a practice in the Paulsbow area, which is just across the water from Seattle. So I go there. That is where my compounding pharmacist is that makes a lot of the compounds for my bioidentical hormone balancing that I do.
Mm-hmm.
So in my practice, I focus on bioidentical hormone balancing. I treat functional endocrinology problems such as hypo and hyperthyroidism, low adrenal function, as well as providing breast cancer and heart disease prevention programs. I do thermal imaging in my practice, which is an excellent way to do breast cancer screening without subjecting ourselves to radiation or damage to our breast tissue. And I think in light of the situation with the information that came out last fall, we're realizing now that the radiation we're using on women is probably doing overall more damage than good in the long run, and we need to relook at what we're doing for breast cancer screening. So I love what I do, and I encourage people to look at my website and give our office a call if you have any questions.
So if there's somebody on the East Coast that wanted to consult with you, you can do it on the phone?
Absolutely. Yeah, I consult with people all over the United States. Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. You've been a very enlightening interview. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good evening.
You too. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health.
Just
tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr.